Communication number 03101079, Brad Allen and Brenda Lee Stabler. The matter before the court is debtor Brad Allen Stabler and debtor Brenda Lee Stabler's motion for contempt. Pat Doherty and Lee Schoenbeck appear for debtors. Roger Damgaard and Sandra Moorhead appear for John Byers and First State Bank of Roscoe. Mr. Doherty, do you by any chance have a settlement to report?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Having reviewed the party's submissions, I am now prepared to issue my ruling. The long and winding road the parties have traveled to arrive before this court is set forth in detail in the findings entered by the state court in the lawsuit involving debtors First State Bank of Roscoe, or Bank, and John Byers, among others. While I adopt those findings, in the interest of time, I will not repeat them. I will, however, highlight some of them to provide context for my ruling. Debtors filed a petition for relief under Chapter 7 on May 13, 2003. On that date, debtors owed Bank the principal amount of $608,124.55. Bank is owned by Byers. Debtors listed Bank as a secured creditor on their bankruptcy schedules. Debtors did not reaffirm their debt to Bank. Debtors received a discharge on August 12, 2003. On March 9, 2004, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents executed a promissory note in the principal amount of $650,000 in favor of Bank for the stated purpose of refinancing debt and a mortgage to secure the promissory note. On the same date, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents executed an additional promissory note in the principal amount of $416,000 in favor of Schurz, which the state court described as a partnership. If the record contains a better description of Schurz and its relationship, if any, to debtors, Bank, or Byers, I have been unable to find it. On April 19, 2004, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents executed an additional promissory note in the principal amount of $213,000 in favor of Roger Ernst. Again, if the record contains a better description of Ernst and his relationship, if any, to debtors, Bank, or Byers, I was unable to find it. On May 27, 2004, quote, in consideration of $379,000, end quote, and, quote, in consideration of $37,000, end quote, a total of $416,000, Bank assigned the March 9, 2004 mortgage and the notes secured thereby to Schurz. On the same date, quote, in consideration of $213,000, end quote, Bank assigned the March 9, 2000 mortgage and the notes secured thereby to Ernst. On March 21, 2005, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents executed another promissory note in the principal amount of $213,000 in favor of Schurz and a mortgage to secure $629,000. On April 5, 2007, Ernst released the mortgage that was assigned to him on May 27, 2004 because the, quote, indebtedness thereby secured, end quote, had been, quote, fully paid, satisfied, and discharged, end quote. The state court did not say, but in their brief in support of their objection to debtor's motion, Bank and Byers indicate this indebtedness, $213,000, was assigned to Schurz. In May 2007, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents filed a state court complaint against Bank, Arnold Schurz, Ernst, United Bankers Bank, and Ipswich State Bank. In June 2008, debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents filed an amended complaint against Bank, Schurz, Ernst, Ipswich State Bank, and Byers. On August 18, 2008, Schurz assigned the March 9, 2004 promissory note for $416,000, the March 9, 2004 mortgage securing that promissory note, the March 21, 2005 promissory note for $213,000, and the March 21, 2005 mortgage securing that promissory note to Byers. On that same date, bank and buyers served their answer to debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents' amended complaint and their counterclaims against debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents. Of the eight counts in bank's counterclaim, two implicated debtor Brad Stabler. Both of those counts were resolved by stipulation of the parties. Of the eight counts in buyer's counterclaim, six implicated debtors. In January 2009, debtors filed an adversary complaint asking this court to impose sanctions against buyers for an alleged violation of the discharge order in pursuing his counterclaim against them. In July 2009, I dismissed debtor's adversary complaint for failure to state a claim. Alternatively, I abstained from hearing the matter. Debtors appealed my decision to the bankruptcy appellate panel. In August 2009, the state court granted summary judgment in favor of buyers on two of the six counts in his counterclaim that implicated debtors. These counts involved an entirely different promissory note, which bank and buyers refer to in their brief in support of their objection to debtor's motion as the ISB note and the related security agreement. The state court subsequently effectively reversed itself on this point, finding there was an issue of material fact regarding whether the promissory note was enforceable against debtors. In November 2009, the bankruptcy appellate panel affirmed my decision to abstain from hearing debtor's adversary complaint. In April 2011, the state court granted summary judgment in favor of debtors on the remaining four counts in buyer's counterclaim that implicated debtors. These counts involved the promissory notes and mortgages that were ultimately assigned to buyers. The state court found the promissory notes and the related mortgages were invalid reaffirmations of debt that had been discharged in debtor's bankruptcy and were unenforceable against them. In July 2013, following a bench trial, the state court again ruled in favor of buyers with respect to the ISB note. In December 2013, the state court entered a final judgment. Debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's parents appealed the state court's decision to the South Dakota Supreme Court. In June 2015, the Supreme Court affirmed in part, reversed in part, and remanded for the entry of a judgment consistent with the Supreme Court's opinion. Insofar as I can tell, the record is silent as to what happened in the state court after that. However, I trust if anything had transpired that would affect either the state court's findings or my analysis of them, someone would have called that to my attention. In any event, in December 2015, debtors filed a motion for contempt that is now before me. Bank and buyers objected to debtors' motion. In February 2016, I held a preliminary hearing to determine whether either side wished to present additional evidence. Both sides reported they had no additional evidence to present. In April 2016, I granted bank and buyers motion to supplement authorities and allowed debtors time to respond to bank and buyers additional authority, which they did. I then took the matter under advisement. Before I get to bank and buyers substantive arguments, I will address their several procedural arguments. Bank and buyers first argued debtor's motion is barred by collateral estoppel because this court already abstained from considering these claims. This argument misconstrues my decision to abstain from hearing the earlier matter. In deciding to abstain from hearing that matter at that time, I stated, quote, I believe it would be possible, even preferable, to sever debtor's state court claims, allow the state court to determine, as it already has with respect to count one of buyer's state court counterclaim, whether any of the debts buyers is seeking to collect have been discharged. And if the state court determines, albeit contrary to the express language of counts three and four of buyer's state court counterclaim, any of those debts have been discharged, allow debtors to renew their complaint. End quote. I abstained from determining whether any of the debts bank and buyers were seeking to collect had been discharged because, as I explained at some length in my earlier ruling, the state court had concurrent jurisdiction to make that determination. But, depending upon what the state court determined, I invited debtors to renew their request for sanctions. Bank and buyers next argued debtors' motion is barred by collateral estoppel because this court dismissed debtor's earlier complaint for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. This argument ignores the effect of my decision to abstain from hearing the matter at that time. I dismissed debtor's earlier complaint both for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted and based upon my decision to abstain from hearing the matter. On appeal, the bankruptcy appellate panel affirmed only my decision to abstain from hearing the matter. This would seem to be at least an implicit rejection of my decision to dismiss debtor's earlier complaint for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. However, even if that is not the case, it defies logic to suggest I can both abstain from hearing a matter and grant relief with respect to that matter. Consequently, my decision to dismiss debtor's earlier complaint for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is a nullity. Moreover, even if I could both abstain from hearing a matter and grant relief with respect to that matter, the landscape has changed significantly since I dismissed debtor's earlier complaint. At that time, I was primarily concerned about the language Byers included in counts 3 and 4 of his state court counterclaim, to wit, he was, quote, requesting judgment against debtors only for those amounts determined not to be discharged in their prior Chapter 7 bankruptcy, end quote. I question whether any reasonable interpretation of that language would permit me to conclude Byers was in any way attempting to collect, recover, or offset a debt discharged in debtor's bankruptcy. However, the state court's findings cast that language in an entirely new light. Quote, put simply, fine print that provides that a creditor who is clearly seeking to collect a debt should not be viewed as seeking to collect a debt in the event that the creditor is prohibited from doing so is deserving of no weight, end quote. In re Zine, Z-I-N-E, 521BR 31 at 40, note 64, Bankruptcy District, Massachusetts, 2014. Like the fine print in Zine, and contrary to my initial impression, the prophylactic language Byers included in his state court counterclaim can no longer be given any weight, especially in light of the state court's finding that the entire debt was discharged and there were no amounts determined not to be discharged in their prior Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Bank and Byers next argue the court should abstain from considering debtor's motion. This argument is without merit. None of the 12 factors identified in Williams v. City Financial Mortgage Co., N. Ray Williams, 256 BR 885 at 893 to 94, Bankruptcy Appellate Panel, 8th Circuit, 2001, that a court should consider in determining whether to abstain from hearing a matter with which we are all familiar, militate against my hearing this matter. Debtor's motion asks the court to enforce its order granting them a discharge. As I previously indicated, this is precisely what I invited them to do when I abstained from hearing the earlier matter. I have the inherent power to enforce this court's orders, and Bank and Byers have not identified any other court that has the power to do so. Consequently, there is no basis for abstention. Finally, Bank and Byers argue the court should decline to reopen the case to consider debtor's motion. This argument is also without merit. Pursuant to Local Bankruptcy Rule 5010-1B1, a case need not be reopened to commence an action relating to a discharge. Turning then to Bank and Byers' substantive arguments. Pursuant to 11 U.S.C. Section 524A2, a discharge, quote, operates as an injunction against the commencement or continuation of an action, the employment of process, or an act to collect, recover, or offset any discharged debt as a personal liability of the debtor, whether or not discharge of such debt is waived, end quote. Quote, a willful violation of the discharge injunction warrants a finding of civil contempt and the imposition of sanctions. The movement bears the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that the creditor had knowledge of the discharge and willfully violated it by pursuing collection activities, end quote. In re Hebner, H-E-B-N-E-R, 2015, Westlaw, 128137, at Star 3, Bankruptcy District, Nebraska, 2015. To the same effect, our In re Hopkins, 2014, Westlaw, 1329163, at Star 7, Bankruptcy Southern District of Iowa, 2014, and In re Lang, 398BR1, at 3, Bankruptcy, Northern District of Iowa, 2008. Quote, the standard of willfulness requires evidence the offending creditor knew of the existence of the discharge order and intentionally took actions which violated its provisions. End quote. In re Poindexter, 376 BR 732 at 738, Bankruptcy Western District of Missouri, 2007. In this case, neither bank nor buyers claims not to have had knowledge of the order granting debtors a discharge. Nor does either claim bank did not take the actions that led debtors to sign the promissory notes the state court found represented discharge debt, or buyers did not file the counterclaim in which he attempted to collect on those promissory notes, and thus that discharge debt. Bank and buyers instead argue they believed in good faith the debt was enforceable. Bank and buyers first point the court to Everly v. 4745 Second Avenue Limited, In re Everly, 346 BR 791 at 797 to 98, Bankruptcy Appellate Panel, 8th Circuit, 2006, in which the Bankruptcy Appellate Panel stated, quote, as long as a creditor has a good faith basis for believing that its debt was accepted from discharge, the creditor is not subject to sanctions for violating the discharge injunction when it proceeds in state court, end quote. That case is of no avail to them, however, as they do not identify any provision of 11 U.S.C. Section 523 under which the debt might even arguably have been accepted from discharge. Bank and buyers next suggest a split in authority regarding the enforceability of post-discharge agreements, such as the ones involved in this case, excuses their actions. As a general proposition and considered in the abstract, this argument might have some merit. However, it cannot be considered in the abstract. In this case, bank and buyer's purported good faith is belied by the findings of the state court in its July 8, 2013 memorandum decision. Quote, according to debtors, buyers and bank intentionally engaged in a course of conduct intended to collect money that was no longer owed by debtors and to defraud debtor Brad Stabler's parents into securing that non-existent debt with their own assets. Buyers and bank attempted to paint an entirely different picture. Their version of the case portrayed buyers as a beneficent owner of a well-intentioned small-town bank who was simply trying to help to prevent debtors from losing their farm. His actions, both personally and as a representative of bank, were portrayed as altruistic. The jury rejected the theory of the case presented by buyers and bank. After reviewing the same evidence as the jury, I also reject their depiction of the events and motivations, end quote. The state court continued, quote, debtors filed for and received discharge from bankruptcy court. The discharge eliminated debtor Brad Stabler's personal guarantee of his corporation's debt. Bank still held security interests in debtor's farm and machinery because such secured interests are not discharged by bankruptcy. Bank still held a security interest worth approximately $110,000 over a quarter section parcel of land owned by debtor Brad Stabler's parents. Bank could have foreclosed on that quarter of land to recover on that debt. Bank could have foreclosed on debtor's land and other secured property. This course of action would have resulted in a significant shortfall for bank. Bank would have recovered some money, but would have taken a significant loss on the various loans of debtors and debtor Brad Stabler's corporation. More importantly, bank would have had no further recourse against any of the Stablers. Buyers understood this. Instead of accepting such a loss, buyers devised a scheme through which he would convince debtors to continue paying on their discharged debt. Alone, this would be practically useless because debtors clearly did not have the resources to service the reaffirmed debt. It was only a matter of time before they would default. Buyer's scheme included a plan to improve bank security interests by convincing debtor Brad Stabler's parents to sign increasingly larger mortgages to their entire farm in order to secure the debt of debtors. This is exactly what transpired. As found by the jury and by this court, $431,900 of the value of those mortgages was obtained by fraud on the part of John Buyers and bank. End quote. The state court then went on to say, quote, the evidence establishes that the purported reaffirmation with bank were not knowingly and consensually accepted by debtors. Instead, the evidence establishes that they were the result of coercive behavior by buyers on behalf of bank. It was clear to debtors that if they did not reaffirm the debt, that bank would foreclose on their property, and more importantly, the property of debtor Brad Stabler's parents. All of this was done without the consent or supervision of the bankruptcy court. This type of behavior is exactly what the reaffirmation process is intended to protect against, end quote. Nothing in the state court's findings suggests either bank or buyers was ever acting in good faith in their post-discharge dealings with debtors. If bank and buyers truly believed in good faith the debt was enforceable, there would have been no need for a scheme or coercive behavior. Instead of the shell game the state court described, a single new promissory note and a single new mortgage would have sufficed. A timely filed reaffirmation agreement would have been even better. For all these reasons, I find banks' actions in coercing debtors to sign the new promissory notes and buyers' actions in pursuing collection of the discharge debt to be willful violations of the court's discharge order that warrant a finding of civil contempt and the imposition of sanctions. Quote, a creditor found in contempt for having willfully violated the discharge injunction is subject to an award of actual damages, including attorney fees, end quote. Poindexter, 376 BR at 738. Debtors have requested actual damages, including attorney fees, damages for emotional distress, and punitive damages. Debtors have not shown they suffered any actual damages other than attorney's fees. And while there is some suggestion debtors may have suffered emotional distress, that claim would need to be tried in district court, 28 U.S.C. Section 157B5. Moreover, debtors have not pointed to anything in the record that would allow the district court to quantify any damages that may have resulted from such emotional distress. In support of their request for an award of attorney's fees, debtors have provided billing statements from Attorney Doherty and billing records from Attorney Schoenbeck. Bank and buyers have objected to the attorney fees debtors have requested for a variety of reasons. Bank and buyers object to the services in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in yellow on Bank and Buyers Exhibit X, that are insufficiently described, for example, worked on file, letter to client, or met with client. Because I am unable to determine whose file Attorney Schoenbeck was working on, his billing records actually indicate that debtor Brad Stabler's parents were his clients. Which client he was corresponding with, or which client he was meeting with, I will sustain this objection. The entries objected to in their entirety, as to which only this objection is raised, total $16,853. I will reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. Bank and buyers also object to the services in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in green, that represent conversations with individuals other than his clients that are insufficiently described. Because I am unable to determine what those conversations were about and whether they had anything to do with debtors or with buyers' state court counterclaim, I will also sustain this objection. The entries objected to in their entirety, as to which only this objection is raised, total $150. I will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. Bank and buyers also object to those services in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in blue, that represent conversations with Attorney Doherty that are insufficiently described. Because I am unable to determine what those conversations were about and whether they had anything to do with debtors or with buyers' state court counterclaim, I will also sustain this objection. The entries objected to in their entirety, as to which only this objection is raised, total $1,908. I will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. Bank and buyers also object to those services in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in red, that represent drafting or reviewing documents that are insufficiently described. Because I am unable to determine what those documents were and whether they had anything to do with debtors or with buyers' state court counterclaim, I will also sustain this objection. the entries objected to in their entirety as to which only this objection is raised, a total $14,920. I will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. Bank and buyers also object to those services in both Attorney Doherty's billing statements and Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in purple, that relate to debtors' unsuccessful 2009 adversary proceeding and their subsequent appeal to those, and to those services in which, in both Attorney Doherty's billing statements and Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, also highlighted in purple, that relate to matters that solely benefited debtor Brad Stabler's parents. With respect to the first purple objection, because I abstained from hearing the 2009 adversary proceeding, in large part because I found debtors were forum shopping, and because the bankruptcy appellate panel affirmed my decision to abstain, specifically noting, quote, how apparent and egregious it was that debtors were forum shopping, I will also sustain this objection. With respect to the second purple objection, because I am awarding debtors the fees they incurred in connection with buyer's state court counterclaim, not the fees debtor Brad Stabler's parents incurred in connection with that counterclaim, I will also sustain this objection. The entries objected to in their entirety as to which only these objections are raised total $28,638.75 for Attorney Doherty and $5,689 for Attorney Schoenbeck. I will reduce Attorney Doherty's fees and will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by these respective amounts. Finally, bank and buyers object to those services and Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, highlighted in orange, that represent clerical work. For example, entries that read organized file, indexed motions and pleadings, located, copied, and mailed order, transcribed dictation, finished copying briefs, scanned and emailed various documents, copied deposition exhibits, calendared deadlines, reorganized pleadings binders, and Bates-stamped documents. Because the services described are clerical, not legal in nature, and are thus part of Attorney Schoenbeck's overhead, I will also sustain this objection. The entries objected to in their entirety as to which only this objection is raised total $6,579. I will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. The reason I have been emphasizing only is there are several entries in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records objected to in their entirety as to which more than one of the foregoing objections is raised. Those entries total $13,019. I will further reduce Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by this amount. That brings us to the 11 entries in Attorney Doherty's billing statements totaling $4,725. And the 174 entries in Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, totaling $69,235, as to which bank and buyers have objected to some, but not all, of the described services. These entries present a real dilemma. Because they are lumped, I cannot say with certainty how much time was spent on the services as to which no objection has been raised, and how much time was spent on the services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained. Under the circumstances, I would most likely be justified in denying these entries in their entirety. However, that would undercompensate debtors for the attorney fees they have incurred and for which they should justly be reimbursed. What I have done instead, therefore, is review each of these entries, determine with respect to each how much time would reasonably have been spent on the services as to which no objection has been raised, attribute the remaining time to the services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained, and then apply the relevant hourly rate to determine the fee attributable to the services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained. In doing so, I relied on my more than 30 years in the bankruptcy field, which includes almost 7 years as an assistant United States trustee and almost 10 years as a bankruptcy judge reviewing fee applications. In the interest of time, I will summarize my analysis of the lumped entries in an attachment to the order that will be entered following this hearing. With respect to Attorney Doherty's billing statements, the fee attributable to the lumped services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained is $1,907.50. With respect to Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records, the fee attributable to the lump services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained is $34,589.50. I will further reduce Attorney Doherty's fees and Attorney Schoenbeck's fees by these respective amounts. In sustaining bank and buyer's objections, I note debtors could have, but did not, supplement Attorney Doherty's billing statements or Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records or otherwise respond to bank and buyer's objections, either in their reply to bank and buyer's objection to their motion or in response to the court's inquiry at the February 18, 2016 preliminary hearing as to whether they wish to present additional evidence in support of their motion. I have done the best I could with what I was given. Quote, the amount of an award of attorney's fees rests within the sound discretion of the court, close quote. Farmers Cooperative Company versus Senske, S-E-N-S-K-E, and Son Transfer Co., 572 F. 3rd, 492 at 500, 8th Circuit, 2009, quoting Walton General Contractors, Inc. slash Malco, M-A-L-C-O, Steel, Inc. versus Chicago Forming, Inc., 111 F. 3rd, 1376 at 1385, 8th Circuit, 1997. Debtors have requested $71,679.25 for Attorney Doherty's fees. After making the deductions I have described, I will award debtors $41,133 for Attorney Doherty's fees, plus sales tax at the current rate of 6.5%, for which bank and buyers will be jointly and severally liable. Debtors have requested 50% of $180,789 or $90,394.50 for Attorney Schoenbeck's fees. After making the deductions I have described from the $180,789 figure, which was the starting point for bank and buyers' objections, I will award debtors $87,081.50 for Attorney Schoenbeck's fees, plus sales tax at the current rate of 6.5%, for which bank and buyers will also be jointly and severally liable. I specifically find both these amounts represent reasonable compensation for the services Attorney Doherty and Attorney Schoenbeck rendered on behalf of debtors in connection with bank and buyers' violation of the court's discharge order. And just so there is no misunderstanding, I am not suggesting debtors or debtor Brad Stabler's parents should not pay Attorney Doherty and Attorney Schoenbeck for the balance of the fees requested. I have no say and take no position regarding that. Bank and buyers have not objected to any of the expenses for which debtors seek reimbursement. Under the circumstances, I would most likely be justified in allowing those expenses in their entirety. However, I will not do so for two reasons. First, it is readily apparent from a review of Attorney Doherty's billing statements and Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records that many of the requested expenses clearly relate to services as to which an objection has been raised and sustained. Allowing those expenses would overcompensate debtors for the expenses they have incurred and for which they should justly be reimbursed. Second, it is equally apparent from a review of Attorney Doherty's billing statements and Attorney Schoenbeck's billing records that many of the other requested expenses do not clearly relate to services for which I have allowed compensation. In other words, I cannot tell if those expenses were incurred on behalf of debtors or on behalf of debtor Brad Stabler's parents. Allowing those expenses would likely also overcompensate debtors for the expenses they have incurred and for which they should justly be reimbursed. To what degree, I cannot say, since some of them may have been incurred on behalf of debtors. However, I have no basis for determining that. What I have done, therefore, instead, is review each of the requested expenses and identify those that do not clearly relate to a service for which I have allowed compensation. This was difficult, if not impossible, for the expenses that were lumped. In any event, in the interest of time, I will summarize my analysis of the requested expenses in an attachment to the order that will be entered following this hearing. I will disallow those expenses that do not clearly relate to a service for which I have allowed compensation. With respect to Attorney Doherty, the disallowed expenses total $1,218.33. With respect to Attorney Schoenbeck, the disallowed expenses total $6,149.95. I will reduce Attorney Doherty's expenses and Attorney Schoenbeck's expenses by these respective amounts. Debtors have requested $2,801.69 for Attorney Doherty's expenses. After making the deduction I have described, I will award debtors $1,583.36 for Attorney Doherty's expenses, for which bank and buyers will also be jointly and severally liable. Debtors have requested 50% or of $13,377.20 or $6,688.60 for Attorney Schoenbeck's expenses. After making the deduction I have described from the $13,377.20 figure, which was the starting point for my review, I would have awarded debtors $7,227.23 for Attorney Schoenbeck's expenses. However, since that is more than debtors have requested for Attorney Schoenbeck's expenses, I will instead award them the $6,688.60 they have requested, for which bank and buyers will also be jointly and severally liable. Again, I am not suggesting debtors or debtor Brad Stabler's parents should not pay Attorney Doherty and Attorney Schoenbeck for the balance of the expenses requested. I simply have no say and take no position regarding that. Bank and buyers have also not objected to the $14,785.37 in interest charged by Attorney Doherty for which debtors seek reimbursement. I have not been able to determine how debtors arrived at this figure. When I add up the finance charges reflected on Attorney Doherty's billing statements, I arrive at a different figure, $15,214.95. Obviously, either of these figures would include interest on the fees and expenses that I have disallowed. It would be inappropriate to allow debtors interest on those fees and expenses. I am nevertheless satisfied the record supports debtors' request. Attorney Doherty charged debtors 1.5% interest per month, 1.5% interest per month, or 18% per year on any balance owing after 30 days. Bank and buyers have not challenged this. Even if interest were only calculated from January 30, 2013, 30 days after Attorney Doherty's last billing statement, and not as and when Attorney Doherty billed debtors for the fees and expenses I have awarded them, simple interest on the $41,133 I have awarded debtors for Attorney Doherty's fees and the $1,583.36 I have awarded them for Attorney Doherty's expenses would amount to much more than the $14,785.37 debtors have requested. I will therefore allow debtors the full amount they have requested for interest, for which bank and buyers will also be jointly and severally liable. Finally, in addition to actual damages, quote, an award may include punitive damages where the creditor's violation of the discharge injunction was done with malevolent intent or a clear disregard and disrespect of the bankruptcy laws, close quote. Hopkins, 2014, Westlaw 1329163 at star 7. Quote, punitive damages generally are awarded to punish and deter particularly egregious conduct, end quote. Hebner, 2015, Westlaw 128137 at star 4. In determining the appropriate amount of punitive damages, courts consider, 1, the nature of the defendant's conduct, 2, the nature and extent of the harm to plaintiff, 3, the defendant's ability to pay, 4, the motives of the defendant, and 5, any provocation by the debtor. That's from Hebner, 2015, Westlaw 128137 at star 4 and 5. Having considered each of these factors, I find bank and buyers acted with malevolent intent and a clear disregard and disrespect of the bankruptcy laws. It is readily apparent the state court was appalled by bank and buyers' conduct and scheming to be paid on this discharge debt. And having reviewed the state court's findings, I too am appalled. As a result of bank and buyers' actions, debtors found themselves engaged in almost a decade of litigation in state court, with all the aggravation, disruption, and frustration that litigation entails. They incurred significant attorney fees, not all of which they will be reimbursed for. And perhaps most importantly, they were denied the benefit of their fresh start. bank and buyer's motive was pure and unadulterated greed. They wanted to improve banks' undersecured position by coercing debtors to pay what they, bank and buyers, knew to be a discharge debt. And nothing in the record suggests any of bank and buyer's actions were provoked by debtors. Under the circumstances, I will award debtors punitive damages of $50,000, with half that sum to be paid by bank and half to be paid by buyers. That is a small enough price for them to pay for what they have put debtors through over the past 13 years, and anything less would be unlikely to deter them or others from engaging in similar conduct in the future. The court will enter an appropriate order. Thank you.